I'm just pushing my bike up a little hill right now, but I should be able to get on in a second. Kind of. Okay. It's nice to be biking in the dark, and when I'm not talking to my phone, it's listening to my bike, and then when I stop for a little break, it's that really familiar, crushing silence, which is everywhere here, and it's sort of one of my favorite things about this race is when you do stop and take those little breaks or stop and have a sleep, you know, as long as it's not like minus 40 and you're not really thinking about anything except for how cold and scary it is, that's when you have those moments to appreciate how much wilderness is around, and there's no other quiet like it, and those are the little moments that I really look forward to the most, and they stick with me for a long time, and they keep me going back out here in the dark with a headlamp with a fully loaded bike.
This is Yukon North of Ordinary. I'm your host, Karen McCall. If you hear about someone training for a 430-mile or 688-kilometer race in the north in winter, your first thought might be, why? Your second question might be, how? And then, are they crazy? That's what I'm planning to find out in my conversation today with Jessie Gladish. The Yukoner is training for her sixth Montane Yukon Arctic Ultra. That's a race that follows the route of the Yukon Quest Dog Sled Race, which follows historic winter trails connecting southern Yukon to the Klondike Goldfields. It's the real wilderness, over frozen lakes, through mountain valleys, and endless forest. In the Montane Yukon Arctic Ultra Race, competitors are allowed to travel by foot, ski, or bike. In previous years, Jessie has walked and skied the 430-mile or 688-kilometer distance, which travels between Whitehorse and Dawson City. She also biked a shorter version of the race last year. The longest version is only offered every other year. So, this is Jessie's year to complete her trifecta. Jessie grew up in Whitehorse and has since lived in British Columbia and Utah, but recently moved back to the territory with her husband and two dogs. They live in Dawson City. I'm excited Jessie had time during her trip into Whitehorse to chat with me about the race on Saturday, February 4th. At the time of recording, we're 10 days away. Jessie, thanks for joining me, and how are you feeling?
Yeah, I'm feeling excited and kind of in the time where I want to get started. I've got all my prep done, and I've like packed and unpacked my bike many times. But now is kind of the time where you just like wait for it to start. Like you can't do the next step because, yeah, it comes the day before starting. And so I'm just kind of waiting for that day where I can actually pack my bike for the last time and have my last sleep and get up and start, because that's what I want to do.
For people who aren't as familiar with the race, can you tell me a little bit about it in terms of how it works? Like, it's multiple days, you're carrying all your food and gear with you, that sort of thing.
Yeah, so the race is a single stage race, so that means everybody starts at the same time and they do their own schedule for the rest of the race. There's no forced stops other than a mandatory 8-hour rest at Pelly Farms for the 430-mile athletes. Other than that, everybody is on their own to, go their own pace. And there is a time limit, but they're fairly generous. And as long as you keep moving forward consistently, then, it's possible to get the distance. And there's a marathon, a 100-mile race, a 300-mile race, and a 430-mile race, and they're all single stage.
For the 430-mile race that you're doing, the cutoff's something like 12 days for the total race, I think.
Yes,
right?
I believe it's 13 days total.
That's a long time.
It is a long time. Yeah, definitely.
Obviously, you have sleeping stuff out there, but are you sleeping much while you're out on the trail?
In the 430 mile, I've found that I do sleep a fair amount compared to shorter distance races. Where and when it is sort of, you know, I don't really know what it's going to look like until after the race is done. But typically, I do try to get a few hours of sleep each night, whether it's at a checkpoint or on the trail. It totally depends on pace and temperature and that sort of thing. But I think with a race that's this long, sleep is really important.
I took a quick look at the race roster. I think there's sort of 24 athletes in the 430 mile. Only three people traveling by mountain bike.
Yes, and they're all women.
Oh, that's great. And how much of this race is about like beating your fellow competitors and how much of it is just your own personal journey?
With this race in particular, I feel like it's more the latter, like your own personal journey. I think every year it seems like in each category there is, you know, one or two people that are racing. Sometimes it ends up being two people racing on foot and, you know, they're well ahead of the rest of the field. And which I think is, you know, it's exciting and I think it's sweet that there's people out there doing that. But I also think that it's an opportunity for people who are sort of the mid-pack racers and are just kind of in it for the expedition style, but in a organized way and with the time limits, like it just kind of pushes you to go a little bit faster, not necessarily in a racing mindset. But yeah, it sort of is for both types of people, and there tends to be less of the racers in this.
You've done a number of these races and other races elsewhere. But what draws you to this race in particular, the Yukon Montane Arctic Ultra?
Yeah, that is a good question. And it's been going since 2003, which I did move out of the Yukon around that time, maybe a year after that, after graduating high school. So I didn't actually know about it until I think it was in 2014 or somewhere around there. I saw a few friends had done a marathon in Whitehorse in February and had like beautiful photos of, you know, their frosty hair. And so I looked it up and then I saw that there was a, you know, a race that went all the way to Dawson. And I'd been kind of getting into marathons and half marathons and trail races by this point. So, you know, I definitely had an idea of what, you know, racing distances was like. And having grown up watching the Yukon Quest dog sled race and just growing up in the Yukon experiencing the winter, I was like, well, maybe I'll try the 430. Like, it sounded really cool. And I just decided to go for it. And I ended up loving it a lot. It was super hard. I had all like an emotional roller coaster every minute of it. By the end of it, 12 and a half days later, I arrived in Dawson and, you know, I thought that I'd never do anything like that again because it was so, you know, taxing. But then, you know, as soon as something like that is over, my mind started thinking about what to do next and I wanted to come back and do it again. And yeah, I was totally hooked on it and it is 100% because of where it is.
So this year you're doing the mountain bike, the fat bike version. How have you been training for that?
Well, I guess my training started last year, last winter. I did go in 120-mile fat bike race in Idaho, and then I did the 300-mile race last year, the Montane Yukon Arctic Ultra. Things changed a little bit last year. They just did an out and back. So it essentially was the trail to Braeburn and back. So last winter was sort of my like training winter for this one. So this winter, my training has been a little more lax, I think, as far as, you know, getting out for long rides. I'm sort of banking on some muscle memory and mental memory from last year. But that being said, I have been out on my bike a lot in Dawson, usually a couple hour rides, and I'll go out with my dog for some of it and then take her back home and then go back out. I got some good training in when it was minus 45, and I learned a lot about biking in the cold that week in December. And yeah, my work has been physical outside. So all of these things together, I think, has given me a pretty good base to go off of.
Bikes don't work very well, and I really below minus 25, 30, do they?
No, yeah. I found out that my bike, the gears don't shift around minus 30, 35 and lower. So I basically have to, if I know it's that cold, I have to make sure that I'm in a gear that I like. You know, not too hard, not too easy, but one that I can kind of maintain and, you know, push up hills and that sort of thing. But yeah, nothing works as well in that temperature, like fabric, zippers, clips, like our bodies, like everything changes. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges of this race is when it is that cold.
Fat bikes might be more condition dependent than say like walking or skiing. Like if it snows a foot, then, you know, you have to push your bike a lot, for example. So I guess it's a little bit more of the wild card, isn't it, for this race?
Yeah, I think it is a bit of a wild card. And I mean, skiing could also go in that category. Walking is definitely kind of the, you know, it might be the slowest overall, but it's the most consistent and it's the simplest. Whereas like biking, I think if the temperature and the weather, if everything is like really good, then biking is going to be amazing. I'm like, I can't wait to just go a bit faster on that trail and, you know, hit some downhills and just feel like I'm rolling along. But that being said, when the trail is bad, it's really, really bad. So yeah, I think biking is a little bit of a wild card, especially for me. I'm not super mechanical. I've learned a little bit, but you know, it's a lot of it is just hoping that my bike carries me.
Well, and in your past fat bike races, have you ended up pushing your bike a lot?
Yes, I did push my bike a lot last year in the race. It was extremely warm. The trail was like mashed potatoes. And yeah, there was definitely sections, you know, or like a whole day where I was pushing my bike. I had a couple of really great sections where I was actually riding. And honestly, at the time, and even now, I'm like, it was totally worth it just for that section, like that 60 kilometers or whatever that I got to ride. And yeah, it's you kind of forget about everything else when you do get to ride. So, and then the Idaho race, I did do quite a bit of pushing. There was a lot of fresh snow there as well. So basically fresh snow and lots of snowmobiles kind of chewed up the trail in that race.
For people listening too, you're not just pushing a bike, you've got all your gear on there. So like, how heavy is your bike, do you know?
I don't know. I am planning on finding out before I start. Once, so my bike is at Icicle right now, getting a tune up at the spa. And so yeah, once I get my bike back, I'll kind of get my gear back on it, get my panniers on, and load it up. And then between now and the race start, I'll have it fully loaded and see how much it weighs. But my best guess is somewhere around like 80 pounds, 85 pounds, maybe. Like, you know, the bike itself is like 35. So it's pretty easy to pack on the weight without really realizing it. So I'm trying really hard this year, more so than other years, to pack a little bit more efficiently and not take, you know, all of my fears on the bike. Yeah, I can let some of them go, I think.
What are those fears?
Oh man, all sorts of things. Like, I mean, obviously, the cold is the scariest part about this whole race for me. I'm totally fine with the remoteness. I'm not too worried about the animals that are out there. I mean, there's definitely, you know, there's moose and there's potential for the bears that wake up in, you know, warmer temperatures. There's wolves, but I've only seen tracks and heard them. I haven't seen them out there. And yeah, so the isolation is something that I think gets a lot of people, but I'm, you know, that part of it I do really like. So the cold essentially is my biggest fear. And, you know, my first year I packed like a second stove, which I think at this point now looking back, I'm like, oh my God, I was so worried. But, you know, I've always wanted to make sure that I could help myself, and that's probably one of my fears is needing help. So I bring all that stuff, like, you know, just in case.
As you mentioned, the cold is a serious factor in this race. I think it's what draws people from around the world to do this race. Maybe the scenery, the remoteness, and also just the cold, the kind of hardcore side of things. But people have lost limbs in the past from frostbite, which is really unfortunate. So that just brings me to how do you deal with the cold when you're on the trail? Obviously, like, lots of clothing and stuff. But what are the other things?
It's a constant monitoring, really, where I find, like, if you go off in a daydream or you're really focused on, you know, the time and the miles and, you know, just like getting to a checkpoint, which they're really, really far away on this race. Like they don't come soon enough ever.
Yeah, they're at least 50 kilometers or 30 miles, 30 to 80 miles apart for the most part, aren't they?
Yeah, there is. Yeah, I can't say off the top of my head right now, but how I look at it, especially on foot, on bike is a little bit different, you know, with the pacing, but it's usually a checkpoint every 24 hours, which, you know, that's a long time in between them.
It's longer than most races.
Yeah. So yeah, it's basically, it's a constant monitoring and it's having all of the layers accessible and just kind of like training your brain to just get used to how annoying it is to layer up and layer down and get those hand warmers out, you know, ahead of time. I'm constantly trying to get my hands, you know, keep them circulated, and I like squeeze them and open them and wave them around and hop off my bike if I'm biking and I'm cold, that walking and pushing like will warm you back up. Especially your feet, because when you're biking, your feet just don't move that well.
Hands and feet are crucial, right?
Hands and
if your
feet
hands
are...
get cold, you can't do anything.
Exactly.
Really.
And yeah, your hands are really your lifeline out there, you know, in conjunction with your brain, which, you know, as long as you're drinking enough and eating enough and resting, if possible, then, you know, that should stay relatively sound. I question how sound it is to start with, but for all of us. But yeah, your hands, like if your hands go, then, you know, all of the things that you need to do are either impossible or much harder. Like if you think about, you know, trying to open your sleeping bag with your hands closed, like, you know, it just, the time will be sucked away and you'll get colder and colder. So yeah, I try very, very hard to stay warm and comfortable. Like I don't get to that point where I start shivering, and if my hands are icy cold, like, do something about it right away. Like there's no waiting around for anything to reverse itself, and nothing will do it for your body except for you. It's yeah, it's a constant monitoring process, and it doesn't end until you're at the finish line.
Are you trying not to sweat as well? Is that
Yeah, trying not to sweat. I'm definitely having trouble on the bike with figuring out the right layers, and yeah, it's hard work on a bike, and it's hard not to sweat. But the idea is to sweat as little as possible, and if you are damp, to have those layers on hand and, you know, practiced to get changed quickly if they are wet.
Like even down to skin quickly, like putting on a fresh base layer?
Yeah, I mean, I luckily have not had to do that a whole lot out there, or if I have, it's been during a nicer temperature time. I do find that I don't sweat that much in minus 40. So there isn't that, like, you know, stripping down before you get into your sleeping bag kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, I wouldn't take top and bottom off at the same time. I would do my top and then I'd do my bottom, or, like, you know, do socks and then, you know, just, yeah. But I mean, that being said, it's all about practicing all this stuff and kind of knowing how long it takes and where your stuff is, and that all comes into play here. You can't just like show up and know how to do all this stuff, even though it sounds simple, which it is. It's just, it's hard to do in that temperature.
Eating is an important part of staying warm. How does that look for you? Are you just eating constantly out there?
It's not constantly, but it's consistently. I would say if you're not snacking at least every kind of hour or two, you're probably not eating enough, and, you know, it depends what it is too. This year I've made a bunch of my own energy balls and different flavors and stuff. So I've been experimenting with that. And some of them are pretty tasty. Some of them are interesting tasting. It'll be funny when I get to those ones. But yeah, I mean, I do try to snack relatively consistently. And water is really important too. So snacking and eating, you do get a good meal at each checkpoint. And I do like to carry like one of those freeze-dried meals and kind of have one of those on hand per day. And then that way I can use either my hot water or I can boil water and have like a, you know, a real meal versus just snacking. But you don't want only one or the other, and you don't want only sweet stuff or only savory stuff. Like, I feel like it's really important to have that, like, just your regular milk chocolate bar in there as a treat, and maybe some candy that isn't going to break your teeth if it freezes.
Lots of things to think about.
There's lots of things to think about. But you know what? I find that I don't have too much trouble keeping food down out there.
And again, on the bike, an added challenge. Are you stopping to fuel up?
That is also a really good question. And the bike has changed that aspect of it for me. Because when you're walking, you can wear like a little fanny pack or, you know, whatever. And you can do all sorts of things while you're walking. Like, you can warm your hands up, you can open things, you can drink, you can eat. Whereas like on the bike, you're kind of stuck. Unless the trail is really good and you've got like a nice long straight stretch, you can kind of use one hand and like try not to fall over while you're doing it. But I have been able to, you know, take a sip of water and that sort of thing while I'm still rolling. But generally, I've had to kind of adopt the like stop and like do a couple things system and then get going again. So basically I just stop and keep the, you know, straddle the bike and, you know, grab some water, grab some snacks, and then keep going. So
this is your sixth race you're about to embark on. You must have had some challenging times in your previous races. Can you tell me about one or two of maybe the harder moments that stand out?
Yeah, there are a lot. I would say my first year was probably the most intense mentally, and I probably had the most challenges that year. You know, it's the uncertainty, you know, that's what I think about with everybody else who's like coming over here and doing it for their first time. Just, you know, the unknown, you know, I literally felt like the checkpoints didn't exist. And, you know, you're out there for 16 hours, like, you know, wondering when you're finally going to get to this checkpoint, and it's dark and you're by yourself. And, you know, I convinced myself that there wasn't a checkpoint, or that I missed it, or I was on the wrong trail. Like, it's kind of amazing what, even though, you know, you go back to your logical mind and it's like, I, you know, there was nowhere else to go. I'm still going the same direction. There's footprints right in front of me. But yeah, you're still out there very much by yourself. And I remember checking my GPS and the map to see like if I did in fact miss the checkpoint, and I was still hours away from it. Like, I think it, when I checked, I was still 2 or 3 hours away from this checkpoint. And I remember walking and crying and like just the reality of the situation where it's like it is that far and you do have to do it. I mean, you don't have to do it. I chose to do it. But it's, yeah, I definitely had some battles out there with that, with the, you know, the distance and the time. As far as physically, I do find that around three or four days in, my feet get really painful, my joints are sore, but then it's interesting. I've learned that there's a bit of a hump there, and then you get to the other side of it, and things feel better, and your body's like, oh, this is what we're doing. Okay, I can keep doing this. So yeah, there's definitely physical and mental battles. And then I would say after that first year, really, I can think of like a couple times in the cold where I felt really, where I did feel scared. I know that I was, you know, in control and I had all my layers and, you know, I knew what to do. But it was that like cold panic where you just kind of realize how far away you are from everything and there's nobody else to depend on except for yourself. And I think that's what I've really gotten out of this race in general, is learning that I you know, I can trust myself and, you know, I built this base. But yeah, like layering up, putting down pants on, putting my down jacket on, putting my goggles on, and just being like, oh my God, if I don't like warm up and reverse this, then, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. And every time that has happened to me a couple times, I have warmed up and I have gotten over that panic. And all of a sudden, like, I've got body heat again and, you know, I'm like, oh, I'm okay. You know, but it's that, like, it's that kind of panic feeling. And it's all about staying calm and, like, you know, panicking is not going to help at all.
What do race organizers tell you? Like, I think everybody's traveling with a satellite communication device. If you did need to call for help, how long can you expect to wait for that?
Yeah, we all have to carry a two-way communication device. So that's either an InReach or a sat phone. And then everybody also has tracking spot trackers. So the race director and his volunteers can follow along and see where everybody is. But if somebody needed help, yes, they could use their two-way communication. They could phone race headquarters and just let them know what the situation is. But, you know, the bare minimum would be hitting your help button on the spot device. And then that goes to the race headquarters. And then there's also another button, which is the emergency button, like life or death, which has a different routing and it goes to, like, you know, it brings everybody in.
Any of your past Montane, Yukon, Arctic ultras, have you, in any of those low points you mentioned, has quitting crossed your mind?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, quitting has crossed my mind on like day one. I remember the year that I was cross country skiing, which ended up not being a great year to cross country ski. If I could go back in time, I would bike that year. Because the trail was nice and hard packed. And yeah, on day one, I remember being like, why am I doing this again? Like, it's not ideal ski conditions. And I have another potentially, you know, 13, 12 days of this, like, you know, why? And I think every year I really have wanted to quit while I was doing it. But it's funny, I do want to be out there and I do love it. Otherwise, I wouldn't do it. And I think pushing through that feeling of wanting to quit, it's almost like it's like a different part of your mind or a different person who wants to quit. And it's like a bit of a battle. And ultimately, I don't want to quit. Like, there's a part of me that does, but I always ask myself, what would you be doing, you know, if you quit? Are you missing out on something? You know, and maybe that is the thing for some people, and you know, they do want to quit for a specific reason. But yeah, I've always been like, if you quit, then you're gonna end up at home and you're gonna have a bath and be in bed and you're gonna be nice and warm and it's gonna be great. But like, are you gonna wish that you were back out here? Probably yes. And so it's like, you know, you're gonna get to do that in X amount of time. And so just like wait for it and it'll come and do it.
A lot of people probably think doing a race like this is crazy. So why do you do this race?
I mean, I do kind of think it's crazy, I guess. When I look at other people coming from Australia and from the UK and not just once, like over and over again, you know, I'm in my hometown, home territory. And, you know, if the start isn't that far away and the finish isn't that far away. And if I quit, like home isn't very far away. So I do feel like coming from such a long distance for some of the other athletes, like it's such a big commitment and it does seem crazy, but in the same way, it's like, it just is something that I like to do for fun. So I understand why people are coming that far. And I mean, growing up, I don't think I remember feeling like the dog mushers were crazy. It was just something that seemed normal, I guess. And I was curious about what the trail looked like, and it just seemed like such a big adventure. So yeah, it seems a little less crazy to me, but I do understand that that viewpoint.
And you like pushing yourself, obviously.
I do, yeah. I love pushing myself. And I really have discovered that like long distance stuff is super fun. I enjoy the pace. I enjoy moving myself through these various environments and the challenges that come with it. There's a lot of really cool people that you get to meet and see some nice places. Yeah, it's ultimately the challenge, and it's for fun. It's definitely a challenging type of fun, but that's really what it is.
I'm coincidentally I've been in touch with your mom for a separate project I'm working on, and she's done several multi-week ski trips across the Yukon, and I have a journal of hers from, I think it was 25 years ago, and she had an entry in there talking about how much she missed her kids and saying, I wonder if they'll do something like this one day too. Is that something you think about sometimes?
I do think about it a lot, actually, and her and I, you know, I'm lucky enough right now to live in the same town as her, and we were talking about her ski trips and just, you know, how we grew up and, you know, what I'm doing, and she's like my biggest fan with all this stuff. It's really been cool for me to have her so supportive, and I think a lot of it does come from her ski trips and starting from a really young age. Both my parents were into cross-country skiing, and you know, my dad did some fairly long distance ski races. He did 100-kilometer Lopet in Finland, and my mom did the 50K, and then I also saw my mom do all these, you know, ski expeditions. You know, she'd be gone for a month. And I know now that, you know, she did miss us a lot. But I don't remember, you know, being upset that she was gone. I just thought it was really cool that she was doing these things. And I loved all of her friends so much. Like, I thought that they had really interesting lives. And so I have no doubt that, you know, her interest in these kind of long distance trips and expeditions definitely, you know, rubbed off on me and are very inspiring.
She definitely wouldn't think you're crazy.
No, she does understand. My mom did do the marathon with me one year, and my sister. So the two of them walked the marathon with me while I was walking. I was walking in 2017. Yeah, she's been out there on the trail with me.
Big fan.
Yes, yeah.
What is your goal for this year's race?
My goal for this year's race, number one, is to finish. And I'd like to be faster than I was walking. I guess that would be my secondary goal. Theoretically, I should be, as long as everything goes well. But yeah, to be a little bit faster because I'm on the bike.
When you walked, do you remember how long it took you?
Yeah, so when I walked, the first time was 12 and a half days. And then the second time that I was on foot again, I took some time off and was 11 and a half days, I think. And then skiing, I was back up to 12, I think. It was slow. But yeah, so, you know, I don't want to put a number on it for days, but I do want to be a little bit faster as long as everything goes well. But my number one wish is just to finish in Dawson and roll into town and be, you know, a minute bike ride from my house. And I've been training on that last stretch of the trail into town and thinking about it, so just really excited for the opportunity to finish there.
For people who want to follow along, what's the best way to do that?
The race website they'll have a link to the spot tracker, the spot tracker's website, and then you can follow everybody's dots. It'll have their bib numbers and names and probably a picture, and then their public Facebook page, the Yukon Ultra Facebook page. They do a good job of updating it as the race goes along. So yeah, those two platforms are a good place to start.
And the race website is arcticultra.de. And the race starts Saturday, February 4th. Thanks so much for joining me, Jesse, and good luck.
Yeah, thanks, Karen. It's been really fun.
To see photos of Jesse and her loaded bike from last year's Montane Yukon Arctic Ultra, check out the Yukon North of Ordinary Facebook page. That's it for this episode of Yukon North of Ordinary, the podcast. Please share this episode and leave us a review. It really helps. Subscribe anywhere you get your podcasts. You can also subscribe to our print magazine by going to northofordinary.com. While you're there, check out Yukon North of Ordinary merchandise. And for a full product line, visit the Bricks and Mortar Store in Whitehorse, located on the corner of 2nd Avenue and Steel Street, across from City Hall. There's a great selection of clothing, hats, stickers, glassware, and more. Do you have something to say about this episode? We'd love to hear from you. Find us on social media at North of Ordinary. You can also contact me, Karen McCall, with feedback or story ideas. Editor at northofordinary.com is my email. Thanks to the whole team at North of Ordinary Media. Our podcast artwork is by art director Manu Kegenhoff. Our music is by Head Candy and tribeofnoise.com. Thanks for listening. We have another episode coming out soon. I hope you listen in.